Welcome to the Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the people responsible for the advances in science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We'll talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science, or the people wielding it, failed in their quest to catch a killer. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. I am curiously fascinated in how and why these crimes happen and how science has developed to catch and convict these criminals. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. I know I'm not the only one out there fascinated by the science of murder and true crime, so I want us to find each other and learn together. This is a fresh start that's long overdue. I developed the idea of this podcast in the spring of 2024 while on a medical leave from work. I then lost my job, scrambled for a few months, became a traveling health professional, then came home when my husband's health issues meant traveling wouldn't really work for us. As of this week, I am 5 months into a new job at a lovely facility and managing to organize everything around me to my satisfaction. That means I can once again dedicate myself to sharing the fascinating science of murder. Today, we are discussing the science of fingerprints, one of the first scientific techniques to positively match or identify as well as rule out suspects of crimes. Fingerprints are much more accurate than eyewitness evidence or other testimony, much as the perpetrator of the first case to be solved using fingerprints came to find out. They are such a cornerstone of forensic science that today we even informally refer to making your mark by leaving a lasting impression or contribution to something as leaving your fingerprints on it. While not new, relatively flashy science of DNA, fingerprints have only been in use since the end of the 19th century. Remember, forensic science as we know it is like any science ever developing. One of the most significant developments was by a Croatian anthropologist named Juan Vucevic. Vucevic had studied the work of Renaissance man Francis Galton, who had originally developed a system of classifying fingerprints and then expanded upon his work. He immigrated to Argentina, and there he pioneered the use of fingerprint analysis by means of friction ridge identification. In 1892, a murder was committed in Necochea, Buenos Aires, Argentina. There was a witness to the crime of the murder of two children, their mother, Francisca Rojas. She escaped the attack with only minor injuries, including a cut to her throat. She accused her neighbor and possible lover, Pedro Ramon Velasquez, of having committed the crimes. The police believed the traumatized young mother completely and submitted Velasquez to 3 days of extreme questioning that pretty much amounted to torture trying to get him to confess to the crime. He maintained his innocence. Since he refused to just confess to the crime despite being subjected to torture, the police were pretty well stumped about what to do next. Police Inspector Alvarez of the Central Police was called in to assist with the stalled investigation to determine who had committed this horrific crime. Alvarez had previously received training from Juan Vucevic in fingerprints and fingerprint identification, and he remembered this training when he investigated the crime scene and found a bloody fingerprint on the bedroom door. He removed the bloody section of wood and returned with it to police headquarters. He then compared the details of the bloody fingerprint to the two main suspects, Velasquez and Rojas. Velasquez, the man that had been subjected to more than 3 days of torture to confess, was shown to be innocent. Francisco Rojas, on the other hand, had murdered her children, staged the crime scene, and accused her neighbor of murder. She was a young, pretty woman who had appeared to be injured in the attack. She might have gotten away with it. If her bloody fingerprint had not been found and identified at the scene. Turns out her motive was the common trope of wanting the love of the wrong man. Alvarez learned that Rojas had another boyfriend who had been overheard saying he would marry her except for those two brats. So, like many horrible mothers before and since, she decided to eliminate the complications. Bonus, she could frame her other lover at the same time, tying up any loose ends so that she could have the future she desired. As a result of the Rojas murders, Argentina became the first country in the world to file its criminal records based solely on fingerprint classification. The resulting classification system is still used by many South American countries today. Fingerprint identification, as used in forensic science, is also known as dactyloscopy. It's the process of comparing two instances of friction-rich skin impressions from human fingers, or occasionally toes, the palm of the hand, the sole of the foot, or even the ear, to determine whether these impressions could have come from the same individual. As you touch surfaces, the sweat, oils, and other natural substances from the pores and glands on your skin leave an impression of the friction ridge patterns behind. These invisible natural prints are also referred to as latent prints. There are also patent or visible prints left behind in blood or paint or a similar tacky substance, as discussed in two of today's cases. Finally, there are plastic prints, which are left in soft materials like wax or a wet bar of soap, where the seemingly invisible fingerprints deform a substance they come in contact with to leave three-dimensional impressions. A fingerprint is made up of the unique friction ridges and furrows in the skin on the tip of the finger, left behind whenever we touch, grab, or hold items. In 1684, Dr. Nehemiah Grew published the first paper in the Western world to scientifically describe and illustrate the intricate ridge patterns of the fingers and palms. These raised lines that leave their impression behind in the fingerprint are called friction ridges. The ridges that form patterns can be classified into arches, loops, or whorls. Loops are just that. Lines that swoop up and then back down in a roughly oval shape. Approximately 60% of patterns in fingerprints are loops. Next, whorls are more circular or spiral patterns, like a bullseye. They account for approximately 35% of identifiable patterns. Lastly, arches are lines with a rise in the middle, kind of like a flat drawing of a mountain or a hill. These account for the approximate remaining 5%. There can also be other identifying marks or patterns in and among the ridges called dots, bifurcations, and points. In 1823, Dr. Johannes Purjinki published a thesis categorizing these fingerprint patterns into 9 distinct types, such as loops, arches, and whorls. Though at this time, he was just recognizing patterns. He did not suggest the use of fingerprints for individual identification. It was in 1892 that Francis Galton published his book, Fingerprints, and established the individuality and permanence of fingerprints. It was one of the first books to provide a scientific basis for matching fingerprints and for their later acceptance in court. There have never been any matches in fingerprints found between two different individuals, not even among twins, though people have tried, and computer pattern matching is now a thing. Fingerprints are thought to be the result of the growth rate of the fetus and amniotic friction in combination with certain inherited characteristics. And since these conditions can't be replicated even among twins, it remains unlikely that a match will ever be discovered. Even by the early 1900s, fingerprint identification was known as a common science. It is said that in 1934, John Dillinger even tried to remove his fingerprints to avoid being tied to his crimes. However, fingerprints remain stable throughout a person's life, even after injuries, unless the underlying basal layer of the skin is destroyed. So he and other criminals who attempt this method are largely unsuccessful. Prints are still evaluated based on the same descriptions of arches, loops, and whorls described by Sir Francis Galton in his book Fingerprints in the late 19th century. The techniques for collecting them and comparing them to suspects has remained largely unchanged. In fact, even with today's computer analysis, the final verification of fingerprint matches is often done by a human being using these same classifications and techniques. While commonplace today, the first case in the United States where fingerprints were used in a criminal trial was a 1910 robbery homicide. Thomas Jennings, an African American man who had just been paroled 6 weeks earlier, was stopped half a mile away from a crime scene wearing a torn and bloodied coat and carrying a revolver. This was strong circumstantial evidence. However, it was a fingerprint that he left behind on a freshly painted railing when he used it to hoist himself through a window at the Hiller House that would be the focal point of his trial. Police photographed, cut off, and collected the railing itself as evidence, claiming it would prove the identity of the burglar. In the eyes of the court, they were right. Hiller's murder would lead to the first conviction using fingerprint evidence in a criminal trial in the United States. As with many new scientific discoveries, the public, and therefore the jury, were skeptical of these new claims by the police and prosecution. The defense raised many objections. They tried to collect prints from the public to invalidate the individually identifiable claim. He even challenged the police to elicit his own fingerprint from a piece of paper he touched. They were able to do so. He ended up looking a little dumb, and the fingerprints from the crime scene were admitted into evidence. In 1911, the Illinois Supreme Court ruled in the case of People v. Jennings to uphold this murder conviction based on fingerprint evidence. This formally established the admissibility of fingerprints in U.S. courts. Though it has been at times controversial, the use of fingerprint evidence endures more than a century later. It's really cool. In one of more relatively recent cases, the police had to go to extraordinary lengths to outsmart a criminal who tried to hide his fingerprints and any other identifiable characteristics. From June 1984 until August 1985, there was a serial killer operating in Los Angeles and the San Francisco Bay Area of California. The killer, nicknamed the Night Stalker, was a very organized perpetrator who left little to no evidence behind. DNA was not yet a thing, and Richard Ramirez had left no fingerprints that the police could find. At any of the crime scenes where he committed countless instances of burglary, battery, murder, attempted murder, rape, and attempted rape, the police were frustrated and unable to identify the killer, whose crimes were described as cruelty, callousness, and viciousness beyond any human understanding. In August 1985, one of the victims of an attempted home invasion robbery noted the color, make, style, and partial plate of the vehicle used by the perpetrator. This was seen as a huge breakthrough. In addition, the police were able to cast a footprint at the scene and even located the car 4 days later. The footprint would have been very conclusive evidence due to the rarity of the shoe that made it. However, the mayor, trying to make themselves look good, released the information about the unique shoes to the media. Ramirez, not being completely dumb, immediately disposed of them. He may have been accused of being crazy in the press, and it was an image he certainly played into, but he wasn't stupid. So the police were having trouble finding evidence and having trouble connecting what they did have to a perpetrator. In fact, the police were having a great difficulty in even locating a fingerprint from the recovered car because Ramirez had wiped it down meticulously before abandoning it. Finally, using laser detection, they were able to locate a single print that he had missed cleaning away on the rearview mirror. This was a lucky find because laser lights like they use don't require moisture, but traditional fingerprint patterns don't adhere to dried prints, so they would be able to lift the print in the usual manner. Luckily, because Ramirez hadn't always been so meticulous, there was a match to that recovered print in the database. It was even a luckier strike that the police had Ramirez's prints on file because the California database they were using only contained the fingerprints of criminals born after January 1st, 1960. Ramirez was born February 29th, 1960, less than 2 months later. The computer age was just beginning at this stage in the 80s, and the huge databases that exist today were barely thought of. AFIS, or the Integrated Automated Fingerprint Identification System, is a digitalized biometric system designed to capture, store, analyze, and compare fingerprint data. It is a computerized system maintained by the Federal Bureau of Investigation since 1999. It contains the fingerprints and criminal histories of 70 million subjects in the criminal master file, 73,000 fingerprints from known and suspected terrorists, and 31 million prints from civil sources. The FBI established a central repository for fingerprint files in 1924, collecting millions of records. When computers and computer databases started becoming more prevalent through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, the FBI began developing AFIS, known as the Automated Fingerprint Identification System. The AFIS database is composed of digital files, including traditional 10-point cards that are scanned and submitted to the database. If there is a list of possible candidates for a match, nearly eliminated by digital matching, the prints are passed to a specialized technician for a manual check. In 1999, the FBI launched the current system, Integrated Automated Fingerprint Identification System, as a national computerized system for storing, searching, and matching 10-print and latent fingerprints. There is even current technology where fingerprints are now captured digitally and instantly compared to the database. This technology has dramatically sped up the identification process. In fact, AFIS processed more than 61 million 10-print submissions during 2010. I like to joke that I can't be anonymous anymore because I've given my fingerprints to various government agencies over the years. Of course, having served in the U.S. military, that was pretty much one of the rights I signed away. I mean, I even went through an FBI interview for a security clearance when I was in the Army. I gave my fingerprints and participated in my background check. The state of Texas took my thumbprint when I got my driver's license. I was older, but I remember drives to get kids' fingerprints in the case of kidnappings. There's a pretty solid database out there, at least for the American public, and these prints are likely all part of the AFIS database. Remember, your fingerprints do not change throughout your life. Fingerprints, however, like any other science-based technique, can be applied incorrectly. In the 1998 trial of Stephen Collins for armed assault, attempted murder of a police officer, and other related crimes, the prosecution claimed that fingerprints found at the crime scene unquestionably belonged to him. In January of 2004, 6.5 years later, Boston police and prosecutors admitted they were wrong. The main evidence against him was eyewitness identification and the highly damaging testimony of two Boston Police Department fingerprint analysts. The analysts claimed that a latent fingerprint was found on a water mug at this crime scene unquestionably belonged to Collins. This forensic testimony was a key factor in his conviction, which led to Collins being sentenced to a term of 35 to 50 years in prison. In 2004, Collins, with the help of the New England Innocence Project, sought DNA testing on the physical evidence found at the crime scene, including the water mug stated to have his fingerprints and a sweatshirt. The DNA test conclusively proved that the genetic material on the mug and the sweatshirt did not belong to Stephen Collins. The DNA was from one person, and that person was excluded as Collins despite the earlier testimony. Following the DNA results, the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office re-examined the original fingerprint evidence. 2 days later, a judge granted Collins a new trial based on the DNA. The district attorney officially stated in court, "I can conclusively and unequivocally state, Your Honor, that the purported match was a mistake. The charges against Stephen Collins were dismissed, and he was exonerated after spending 6.5 years in prison." The Collins case is highly significant in the history of forensic science because it was the first case in the United States where a defendant convicted primarily by fingerprint evidence was later exonerated by DNA. This exposed the potential for human error and subjective judgment in the latent fingerprint examination process, which had long been characterized in court as an infallible science. The case led to an internal investigation of the Boston Police Department's latent fingerprint unit and highlighted the need for greater standardization and quality assurance in the field. I think fingerprints have been around so long and have been seen as inviolable evidence for so long that investigators will let themselves get sloppy. No physical evidence is always perfect. When there are low-quality prints or prints that have not been evaluated to an acceptable level of scientific certainty, it is very important that all accepted guidelines and standards are kept to ensure justice is being served. There's even been a proposal for use of other prints in forensic science, most notably ear prints, to serve as an alternative or supplementary method for individual identification to complement traditional fingerprints and DNA evidence. The general principle is based on the idea that the unique and stable shape of the human ear can leave a distinctive two-dimensional impression when pressed against a surface. The most reliable and accepted current use is to exclude a suspect. If a recovered ear print does not match a suspect's ear, that individual can be eliminated from the investigation. An ear print can be used to support other evidence placing a suspect at the crime scene. In some European jurisdictions like the Netherlands and Spain, they have been used successfully as a strong piece of circumstantial evidence. While proposed, ear prints are not currently accepted for sole identification of a suspect. There have also been discoveries, like the collection of fingerprints in the Richard Ramirez case, that have advanced our uses of fingerprint science. In 2008, researchers at the University of Leicester, UK, the same place where Sir Alec Jeffreys first developed DNA profiling, discovered a new technique for identifying fingerprints on metal, such as shell casings from a gun. This method enables forensic scientists to visualize fingerprints even after the print itself has been removed. However, many people ask if with the advent of DNA and its associated science, how important are fingerprints in our current forensic arsenal? I think that any working and properly used tool still has a place in our arsenal, and you never know when you'll need it. The Night Stalker was caught due to a random fingerprint that he didn't anticipate, after all. In each of these cases, the perpetrators were caught and convicted based on the fingerprints that they left behind. Think of all the things that you come in contact with on an average day. What do you touch? What are you leaving your fingerprints on? What traces are you leaving of your presence? I'd love to hear from you on social media or email about forensic science, weird places that have collected your fingerprints, or any future topics you'd like to suggest. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder. I can also be reached at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to this podcast to continue learning about the science of murder. Please stay around to hear the next episode, and please leave a review of these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcast provider, and encourage your accomplices, I mean friends, to learn along with us.